Hello, I am Scott Jones. I'm the director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon. And this panel is titled Electronic Frontiers Gathering. We would like to talk about our experiences with the last 10 or 11 years of Electronic Frontiers Georgia, which is a local activist group that Robert here actually founded. He started back in 95, and I got involved in January of 96. So it's hard to believe that, for me, it's been almost 10 years. That doesn't necessarily mean 10 constant years of doing something every single month, every single day, but it has been 10 years since we started, which is a long time. So I kind of wanted to talk about where we've been with this, maybe where we're going with it, and talk about some of the history. I wondered if you could, Robert, if you could tell a little bit about how you got started in 1995 and what idea did you have that prompted this to get started?
I guess that I'm out of luck and you got the recording facility to work. I was hoping it wouldn't be recorded. Just out of curiosity, how many people here are actually from Georgia? Really? Wow. Okay. How Electronic Frontiers Georgia got started? Well, if you want more precise details, ask me. I'm somewhat flippant sometimes when I'm talking, particularly a gathering like this, because if you notice the people walking around in the costumes in the hallway, not everything is so serious. Basically, back around, I think, 95, maybe June of 95, a guy probably by the name of Philip Elmer DeWitt or something like that was in writer or something at Time Magazine, and he produced this thing called, I forget exactly what it was, had a picture of like a baby or something on the cover of Time, and talked about how porn was pervasive, or a little child on the cover of Time or something. And shortly thereafter, some senator or someone, I don't really recall who, was on the floor of Congress waving the magazine around saying, you know, all this porn on the internet, we got to do something about it. Well, I don't wish to imply I'm a prude, because people that know me might have a totally different view of me, but my first reaction to the article was, where is all this pervasive porn? I've never actually seen it. Now, I realize if you go searching for porn on the internet, you're going to find it, but the implication of the article was that it was just out there, and it was going to hit you in the face no matter what you did. And while that may even be true today, and you can't get away from email that slaps porn in your face, I'm telling you, back in 95, this just was not the case, and it was nowhere near the case. There was, in fact, porn there, just like this hotel has a strip club right beside it over next to the expressway. I don't know which direction you'd go to get to it. I've never actually been there, but in my hotel room last night, I saw the neon lights. I therefore know it's there. But I wouldn't see it if I wasn't on the 21st floor looking down. I just wouldn't know it was there. I had the same situation in 95. I did not know where all this porn was. And so my first reaction was, this article just is a bunch of garbage. As it turned out, some guy named Marty Rims from Carnegie Mellon University as a prank, or maybe as a get-rich scheme, had supplied Time Magazine and certain other people with copies of a study he had done talking about pornography on the internet. And he did this in an attempt to maybe help. It was theorized that he was selling bulletin board operators materials on how to make more money off of porn on your bulletin board, and so he did all this as sort of a way to gain credibility and get more customers. But the entire thing got debunked. Well, the interesting thing about the internet is that once this article came out, the entire internet kind of rose up and said, well, where's all this porn he's talking about? It's not really there, and it doesn't quite work like that. And yes, there was porn on the internet, I'm sure, though I'd never seen it. I could probably tell you where it was, though I never actually saw it. Yes, I have seen it today. I don't really go looking for that much, but I can show you where it is if you want to know, if you can't figure it out. But everything was basically debunked. And so what happened was a bunch of us got together in Atlanta, and we did the most effective thing people could do. We sat around, drank beer, and complained about the situation. Which, of course, did no good whatsoever, but we all got a good big kick out of it. It turns out just a few days later, the state of Georgia, the General Assembly, our elected officials, in their wisdom, chose to pass a law making it illegal to falsely identify yourself on the internet. And so poor little me, who runs around calling himself Pooh Bear, suddenly became a master criminal in the eyes of the state of Georgia because my name, in case you didn't know, isn't really Pooh Bear. My name is Robert Costner. And the law specifically said I couldn't use a false name. So in other words, if there are two people on the internet, one calls himself Tarzan, another one calls themselves Jane, and they talk to each other, it was a crime under this new law that was proposed. So this new law, you know, got tabled and so forth, and all of us guys from EFGA sitting around drinking beer, of course, we didn't have much to do with that. We just thought this was terrible and horrible, and we drank beer and we complained, and, you know, then the thing got tabled and there's nothing to do with it. But then on the last day of the session, they pulled it off the table and passed the bill. And suddenly it became a crime to falsely identify yourself on the internet. It became a crime to link through a logo or something like that, something to do with web linking. There's in England, there's a law that was the first case about web linking. We actually predate them by a year, this law that was passed. We predate the civil case by about a year, but we were really the first place where it legally became a crime to link, do a hyperlink on the internet. And so, you know, once again, we sat around, we drank beer, you know, and we complained, and this was, you know, the most effective thing that people can do. Well, somehow or another, and I don't really recall how, I won't claim that it was through my wonderful efforts, but somehow or another, we got a hold of an attorney. His name was Scott McLean at Scott McLean at Bondurant, Elmore, and Mixon. He ultimately got his, I think, name in the front page or someplace on the Wall Street Journal. But he took up our case and helped us out. I'd previously been to the ACLU and said, they've done us wrong. Can you help us? And they said, nope. Nothing they could do. Well, after we framed a little better with the help of Scott, they said, well, yeah, we probably can help you. And then there's actually two ACLUs. There's the Georgia one, there's the national one. So then the national one, after a while, got in on the act. And so we had attorneys at the ACLU in New York. We had attorneys at the ACLU in Georgia. We had an attorney with this regular law firm here in Atlanta. We had attorneys out in, I guess, California with Electronic Frontier Foundation. We had all these attorneys. They generated $350,000 worth of legal fees. And we got a preliminary injunction. The law got declared that it shouldn't be there, and so we succeeded. And we transformed ourselves from a group of beer drinkers that complained to people who actually could be effective and do something by leveraging work of other people with a little help. And then we promptly, for the next couple of years, went back to drinking beer and complaining. But every once in a while, we do something, and about every 2 years or so, we'll spring up and do something that makes some headlines and has some effect. But it's all volunteer work. And one thing I keep saying about EFGA is that EFGA does what you want EFGA to do because you're the one that does it. So anytime somebody wants to help with an issue, come help with an issue, because I've got a real job. I have to pay my bills, and that's what I do for a living. And I just do this when I want to have some fun and when I've got some spare time. And Scott's the same way. So if you want something done, don't just sit around, drink beer, and complain about it. Come help us and get something done. That's kind of how we got started a few years back.
By the way, we have, if you would like to get on our mailing list, we do have a mailing list, sign up on the legal pad that's in the back of the room. We also have some snacks if you're interested. I brought a couple of snack items in. So I was thinking about this as kind of a round table, free-form discussion sort of thing. So to kick off the discussion part, I'd like to ask, has anybody in here been involved with any sort of technology-oriented activism group? Are you perhaps a member of one of the organizations like EFF or EPIC or Public Knowledge or any of those kinds of groups? Anybody here? No. Okay. Well, I think one of the issues we face is that we have had a hard time in the past motivating action until a burning issue comes up. And one of the issues that we had a couple of years ago was the so-called state DMCAs. And we had been dormant for quite some time, and these laws came out. And once we read the laws and realized what was happening, we got really disturbed by that, and we suddenly got active again. So what happened with these laws, the state DMCA, what they really were is they were being pushed by the movie industry, and the movie industry was concerned about the potential for file copying on the Internet. They weren't getting what they wanted out of the federal government. And they were finding it expensive to sue on their own. So they decided that they would go down to the state level, which is something they have a lot of experience doing. And they went down to the state level. They have a network of attorneys across the country who have contacts in all the state legislatures. They have a very well-organized political infrastructure, political machine. And they use that infrastructure to go down and pass legislation that was basically technology control legislation, and the legislation was I don't know that it used the word internet directly, but if you read it, you realized sort of what was going on. It was one of those I guess technology control type issues. You read the law, and you saw that. Some incredibly draconian, punishments for doing fairly ordinary things. It was, if you read it carefully enough, you realize that, you know, this law is basically saying that anything we don't like, we can pretty much make illegal when it comes to technology and when it comes to distribution of content. And the penalties we have are quite severe. If you think copyright violation is the penalty for that is $150,000 per illegal copy, and this was above and beyond that, and this was at the state level. So we saw this at the state level. We got very disturbed about it, and we started. I started emailing everybody I knew. I started calling everybody I knew. We put down. Put together a small cobble of opposition, and we showed up at a committee meeting at a state hearing. And we went down there, and we brought up a lot of points. We asked a lot of questions, and we basically told the legislators that were in this committee our concerns. And the legislators were not only open to what we had to say, but they brought up a lot of concerns on their own with this bill. And so it was nice to see that there was already some skepticism when we got into the room. But once we got there, we were able to bring in a college professor from Georgia Tech and a bunch of professional technology people who could basically reasonably say that this would have a significant impact on the state's technology business. And that added some credibility. Just the fact that you could get four or five people in a room together who have some credentials to say that there's something wrong with the bill is enough to either stop it or slow it way down. And this is a bill that, because we stopped it when we did, it died after a two-year limitation and has not been resurrected in its original form. And this is a bill that has been passed in other states in cases where nobody knew this was going on, nobody knew to show up at the committee meetings. Nobody knew what happened, and this bill was kind of flying under the radar for almost 2 years in other states before activists got wind of it. But what we found is that when we had a burning issue like this, we were able to pull together the group very quickly. And it has been a challenge at times when there doesn't seem to be an issue that's pulling things together like that. Do you have any particular questions about local activism, since I don't see anybody here who says that they have been involved in it? Are you involved in other kinds of activism that are not technology related?
It's been a while. South Carolina, back in the early 90s, passed a law about content bumper stickers. And and a group of us wanted to print our own bumper stickers. It was a political statement.
Mm-hmm. Freedom of speech.
Exactly. And I was one of the people that actually got pulled over by the highway patrol, and I dared him to write me a ticket. He said, you know, it's illegal. I said, yes, it is, and I dare you to write me a ticket because I want you to. And he's like, why? He goes, because the law is not constitutional. It impedes freedom of speech. And he's like, no. And he left. He's like, this is a trap I'm not going to step into. I was a little too eager, I guess. But eventually three of us did get ticketed, and it took us a whopping 3 weeks to get along.
Well, that's
not so technical.
That's amazing that you were able to get the law thrown out. It does take certainly time and effort, and sometimes money, maybe a good bit of money, to bring a legal action at times, just to show that, just to prove that you're right. It's not always a free or easy thing to do. It takes some effort, and sometimes you need to. Sometimes it helps to know some lawyers. You know, helps to know some lawyers who might be interested in your cause and would be willing to volunteer some service, and we have been able to find that in the past, and it's been very helpful.
So we were lucky enough to have the people driving around with bumper stickers for lawyers.
that helps a lot.
Yeah.
It really helps a lot. So go ahead.
So what I know about the EFF is, I guess, what I see in the when it makes the headlines. Can you just describe in a sentence or two, like what the mission or the objectives of the EFF are?
Okay.
Well, first of all,
let
me say, we're not EFF. EFF's a different group, so let's not talk about EFF right now. EFF is a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they're out in California. About 10 years ago, Stanton McCandlish, who was an activist with EFF, encouraged people to start up similar groups around the country, and that's how EFGA got started. So we went from drinking.
Different initials.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say we converted from being people who drank beer and typed on mail list to people who, you know, sat around in bars and drank beer and complained. And so that's kind of what. A quick 5-minute overview of what we've done in the past is, well, EFGA basically looks at the intersection of public policy and technology, and we've concentrated on civil rights, and we focused on anonymity. And most of the stuff we've been involved with has either been privacy or anonymity. And then freedom of speech, you know, has been an issue as well. But it's civil rights type stuff embodying the First Amendment, constitutional issues, stuff that's typically in the Bill of Rights or constitutional. Things we've done in the past have involved the idea that at one time, I don't know if you have encryption on, if you use encryption on your computer programs like PGP, but just SSL, the way of having the little lock appear on your browser when you enter your credit card number, that was considered to be a munitions violation initially, and so they made it 40-bit encryption. Because at 40 bits it was okay, at 128 bits it was a munitions violation, and I think it was very similar to the concept of owning atomic weapons as far as the law that specifically regulated it. So, you know, if anyone ever asks you if you, you know, have any weapons, you can say, well, I have some Class 8 munitions on my laptop. But that's been changed to an ear violation now. But we kind of won the war there. But we argued for encryption at one point, and that was a big thing. Another thing we did was that digital signatures. In Georgia, there was this case where someone needed to do something. You had to get a form signed and turned in to the state by a certain day and hour and minute. And so to do that, he faxed it in. And the court, and because he didn't mail it in with a postmark, it was said that you know, this wasn't valid. And so what in court, the judge ruled that because he faxed it rather than postal mailed it, that what he did was not a writing, it was beeps and chirps. And therefore, it wasn't legal. So what you have to do with a digital signature is you have to establish that you have a writing to begin with, then have some methodology for digitally signing it, and there's a lot of methods out there for doing that, and then you have to get that all legalized. And there was something called the Utah model, because they were the first state to do this, on how signatures and keys and so forth were managed, and who became the Pope of signatures and so forth. And we objected to the process they were looking at implementing for this and suggested something different, and worked with the committee every month for about a year and a half. And we ultimately convinced everyone there was a flaw in the way things were being done. And I don't want to give support for some of the other issues, or lack of support for some of the other issues, but that was the main thing we were after. And, you know, ultimately, people sided with us on that. You know, we present evidence, and one by one, people won over to the idea. Now, maybe the final bill got mangled a bit and so forth, but the point is, we worked with people, and we made some progress. And then the bill's been changed a couple times since then, and the national bill's been put in place, and so, you know, it's but we helped form that very early on before it became a national issue. There was this guy who was moving, I forget exactly from where, maybe Alabama or Florida up to Georgia, and his U-Haul trailer broke down. Maybe broke down once, maybe broke down twice, I don't recall the details. He's a member of EFGA. He didn't like that. So he did something which most companies had never seen happen before. He created a website. His website, I don't recall the name of it anymore, but it was like uhell.com or something like that. And he told the story of what happened with his U-Haul trailer. So imagine you type up what happened with your U-Haul trailer and you post it on the bulletin board on the wall in your bedroom. Nobody really sees it. Big deal. Maybe you put it at the grocery store, supermarket. You know, big deal. You put it on a web page on the internet, and suddenly someone types in U-Haul. Instead of going into a search engine, instead of getting the U-Haul website, they get returned U-Hell. And so he was like the number one rated response for U-Haul when you type that in. And he had people from all over the country that were posting comments about their experiences. Okay. So we hooked him up with an attorney who went to court, you know, and helped him defend himself against U-Haul, who promptly sued him. Because the amazing publishing power of an out-of-work person who could barely afford a U-Haul trailer to help move himself, and because he was out of work, had no money to defend himself. In fact, I don't think he could maintain the fees for the website, so it's gone now. But the point is, U-Haul sued him. Now, it's interesting what they did in the lawsuit. Now, this was back when things were new. This was a new concept. They sued him in federal court, and there's a particular minimum amount you have to get into federal court. If you have a $25 complaint, you can't sue. You got a $100 complaint, you can't sue. I forget what the exact amount is, but I think in order to file this type of lawsuit, you have to have $250,000 of damages. So what they did was they alleged the minimum, $250,000 worth of damages. Then U-Haul made this claim that venue for this need to be not in Georgia, where the guy lives and is producing the website, but in Utah. And U-Haul said this in their affidavits, in their lawsuit, filed by their California attorneys. They said U-Haul only conducts business in the state of Utah and nowhere else in the country. And that's why venue had to be in Utah. The California attorneys filed this, okay? And so, interestingly enough, if you don't show up for the preliminary hearing, you get an award against you, and they asked for treble damages if the person didn't show up. So after they filed the suit, then they filed requesting treble damages because they knew that this guy who was out of work and couldn't even afford to rent the more expensive trailer than U-Haul, couldn't pay for a moving company, that he wouldn't show up for the Utah hearing. So they asked for treble damages of $750,000 against him. The obvious thing they were going to do was present him with a $750,000 judgment, which would be on his credit record, and say, take down your website or give us $750,000. Well, we put in a counterclaim against them, and we got that basically, you know, resolved in a favor that was happy for him and not so happy for U-Haul. But this is what's actually done. And this is the pattern that large companies have started doing. They've started suing people for things because they can't. A large company with deep pockets, it's very easy for them to file a lawsuit, which can cost tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend. And they do it just to get you to change your behavior. It's it's a modern day, intimidation and coercion type thing that we do. They don't carry a baseball bat around and say, we're going to break everything in your store if you don't pay up. They just say, we're going to sue you. And, that is what corporate America is doing. That's what Adobe's done. That's what U-Haul has done. Adobe sued somebody named Tapu here in Georgia. Because Tapu, she had links on her website to other websites, and these other websites told you how to, I don't know what it was, crack the copy protection on Adobe products or something, or maybe told you where you might. Her links went to links that went to links that told you where you could download a copy of the Adobe product. Whatever. Something like that. But they sued her for this contributory infringement philosophy that's never actually been proven in court, and we're still living with this theory today, and they keep trying. It's something which comes out of trademark law, but it isn't in copyright law, and they're trying to implement today. They put bills up every year to try to make this a federal thing, but it's not really a law. But they can allege it in court unless you've got tens of thousands of dollars to defend yourself. You can't really fight it. So I remember at some point it was said that it was actually the software, the SPA or something, the software, whatever, the Software Association or something was doing this. They took a very extreme position, and this was like national press was saying, and EFGA took a very extreme position the other way, and it was because of our efforts that Adobe finally apologized for having done this. Of course, Adobe filed a similar lawsuit a couple of years later, but they don't stop that. They just, get caught every once in a while, and they, quit, and then they do it again later. But there's a lot of stuff like that we've done. And who here owns a DVD player? Has anybody ever put in a DVD and, something happens, you get a commercial for something else or whatever, and you hit, skip or fast forward or something, and the button doesn't work? Have you ever noticed that? Well, that's built into the technology down at the hardware level. And that was implemented in something called broadcast flag. You may not realize this, but all the TV shows have a subcarrier on it that contains this little, it's broadcast flag thing. And it tells your TV whether or not it has permission to fast forward, record, pause, skip, duplicate, and other such things, all your transmissions. Now, does any of your hardware actually implement that? Well, probably you have hardware that does implement that. Most of you probably aren't using hardware, or the hardware is not bothering to pay attention to it. If you have a VCR, it can't implement it. If you have a cable-supplied DVR, like Scientific Atlanta Explorer 2000, what do they use around here? I don't know what you use, but whatever. That's what I have at home. I have a different cable company. Yeah, well, a TiVo-like device, but not by TiVo. The cable company gives you one. When the cable company gives it to you for the digital cable, their box pays attention to that. Have you ever pressed the fast-forward, the pause, or something on your cable box, and it gives you a similar message, and it just doesn't work, or it says operation not permitted? You've seen that happen. Okay. Well, I noticed that one of the cable companies has this, get our cable, it puts you in control. Well, no, it doesn't. You press your button there, and it says, I don't think so. And the cable company wants control of what you're allowed to do and so forth. One of the, I think a vice president or president of Turner, a big local TV station, said recently in an interview, when people fast forward over a commercial, they are stealing money from us. To which the interviewer said, well, if they get up and go to the bathroom, are they stealing from you then?
Change channels during the commercial?
So this law was, so recently the FCC, about a year ago actually, but it went to court and just came out of court last month or so, something called broadcast flag, where they required all makers of things that connect to TVs to honor broadcast flag. So when you hit the record button, it says, I don't think so, it won't let you record. Or when you want to fast forward over something, it says, nope, can't do it. That's called broadcast flag, and that was mandated by the FCC, and all electronic equipment you buy at Best Buys and Circuit City and Sears and so forth is required to do that. A group called Public Knowledge went to court and got that overturned and said that it was not legal for them to ask that because they didn't have the authority to do it. It wasn't that there was something inherently wrong about it, but just that they didn't have the authority to do it. So what happened is that the Motion Picture Association of America, which is actually the lobby behind all this, they went to Congress and said, well, fine, if the end result of the lawsuit is the FCC didn't have the authority to do this, then write up a special bill that grants the FCC the authority to do this, to mandate this, and make them the Federal Computer Commission. And in related news, there's something, I forget exactly what it's called, a trusted computing platform, which is this new hardware design that's being worked on, where they're going to put special security features in your hardware, so that for hardware reasons, people won't be able to steal your identity and give you spam and Trojans and stuff. But the word security has multiple meanings. When Scott was recently telling you that there was this bill that was proposed in the states that would take control of your TV sets, and actually it said it would be a crime in Georgia to connect a piece of equipment that was not authorized by your cable provider, which means if you went to Best Buy's and you purchased something, you brought it home, and a month later the cable company said, you're not authorized to connect that recording device, that VCR to your cable box, it would become suddenly a crime to own that thing which you purchased legally. And a private party would, the cable company would be the arbitrator of what was a crime and what was not a crime. That's what the bill said. And it passed in certain places. It was, I believe, vetoed in Colorado, passed in Florida. We knocked it out of Texas. We knocked it out of Georgia and some other places. A diluted version passed in Virginia. But so there's this trusted computing platform thing. The group that did that model bill was called the, I don't know exactly what it was called, so I don't have it right, was called the Cable Security Committee or something like that. I forget what it was called, but it basically was a cable consortium type thing. It was the MPAA. It was a lobby for them that called themselves the security group or something. And so that was a security group, the idea you're attaching unsecure devices to the cable network. So this trusted computing platform, hardware-wise, talks about the need for security, and that's all it's about. Well, you can implement the same thing in software. In fact, someone did. It's called Longhorn, if you've ever heard of it, or maybe Vista. And Microsoft has is part of the committee that's developing the standard for the trusted computing platform. And what they do is they put the codecs that currently run your audio and your video into protected space so that they are secure. And then you request it give you video output. And if it wants to give you video output, it does. If it doesn't want to give you video output, it doesn't. It says, well, where are you gonna put this video? And you say, I'm going to put it on this Samsung monitor. If it says, I don't like Samsung, I only like Tektronix, then it won't transmit it. It'll only transmit it where it wants to go. If it's the basic premise behind that is, presumably, if you send it to a digitally secure that prevents copying monitor, it'll let the video go out. But if you have a analog monitor or one that doesn't have the digital protection on there, it won't let you see the video that you purchased. That's the concept behind it. So Vista operating system being tested, you know, somewhere, beta tested somewhere near you, that's supposed to be coming out soon. That's another way around that same thing. So Microsoft did this white paper a few years ago called Technology as Policy, and they said that you can implement public policy through law, but you can also implement it through technology. If you design technology a certain way and it gets adopted, it doesn't matter what the laws are. The technology controls what you can and can't do. And they've gotten very, if you read the news, they've gotten very buddy-buddy with the Hollywood recently, because they want to be the center of multimedia. And so they basically have said, well, what does the motion picture industry want from us? And we'll just do it. And it's not what the consumer wants. There's something called fair use, which is constitutionally provided for. There's something called copyright, which is limited protections that content owners have. And the other side of that is a balance called fair use, which is the availability of information which is guaranteed to each of you. Apparently, the movie industry spends more money on lobbying than we do. And they've been getting laws passed that have been taking away our guaranteed fair use rights and giving them more copy protection rights. The motion picture industry, the MPAA sent one of their VPs, he'd recently gotten changed a new position, out to some of the universities to talk to them last month. And he wants to have them change their policies between the students and the universities to make sure that it aligns with what Hollywood wants in terms of computers and digital content and so forth. And I suspect we're going to see in January some laws pop up, and I'm told that there's a complete rewrite of the laws regarding computers and so forth coming up. And so we have some interesting things that we're probably going to see. And I can, as far as the bills go that are introduced, not what's passed, but what's introduced, I can pretty much guarantee you that the content industries, like the Motion Picture Association and the Recording Industry of America, that they're going to get what they want in there. And I suspect that when we see these bills come out, we're going to find that the consumers are very shortchanged in what's available to them. Now, the law that came out a couple of years ago, the what we call the state-level DMCAs, when we went, basically a lobbyist went to, what was the guy's name, the General Assembly guy, Rich Golick? Yeah, I think Rich Golick or something was his name. He's an elected official. He, you know, it's a part-time job. Working at the Georgia General Assembly is a part-time job. You have a regular job, and you do this for a few weeks. That's a part-time job. You get elected to it. Well, he's a good public servant. Some lobbyists came to him and said, we need this. He said, sure, you know, I'm a good public servant. I'll help you take care of it. And they assured him that this was not a controversial issue. You know, and so a bunch of us went down to the Capitol and said, we don't like this. And he was flabbergasted. He had no idea what was going on. And because we objected, because we said we care about this, he backed off and things changed. So come January, I'm telling you right now, these laws, these bills are going to be introduced. And there's people with lots of money, they're going to be asking our good public servants to help them out. So if no one objects, these bills will get passed. And if you think that I'm going to protect you from this, well, I'm like you. I got a job, you know, I work for a living, and if I get some time, I'll look into it, and I might do something. But what we need in January is for people who are willing to make a phone call, willing to write a letter, maybe, if it's a big enough issue, show up for a meeting one morning where they want to see, you know, public comment and public reaction. And we had, like, you know, I mean, if you have 10 people show up on an issue, it can be enough to kill it. We've never had an issue where 500 people showed up, but if 500 people showed up, it might kill an issue too. But it doesn't take much. Just a few people objecting, saying, look, this doesn't make sense. Because these guys who are elected officials, they're not out to get us, even though it does seem that way sometimes. They're really just dedicated public servants that, well, don't know any better. They were told this is not a controversial issue. It's been introduced in other states. It's no problem. Just introduce the bill and get it passed. Everything will be fine. And we're making contributions to your campaign. But they want control of your remote control. They want your remote control to quit doing what you tell it to do. And they've got 10 different ways, and I haven't even gone into international treaties. CAFTA that was recently put out and so forth. Let's not talk about anything about CAFTA, but what it's done is there's this language that gets stuck, this boilerplate language that's being moved from treaty to treaty that has that totally takes away rights you've traditionally had for the last 100 years as far as intellectual property goes, and takes it away from you. And then once they get the treaty passed, well, we've agreed to do it, and then we have to pass laws that match our obligation in the treaty. So they've got a dozen ways they're doing this, and the state General Assembly is just going to be one of them come January. So that's something we're going to have to look at and do things with. I think we're out of time, aren't we?
Actually, we could switch to Q&A here and take a few minutes of questions if anybody has any questions or comments. Okay, Kiska?
Yes, ma'am.
Actually, I do have a question. In the 80s, during the advent of the VCR, when the MPAA tried to sue when people were recording television.
Yes, Universal Studios versus Sony. We, in fact, have a later panel, don't we, that talks about the Grokster decision. That's called Betamax. If you hear attorneys like to talk about terms that nobody else understands, that's called the Betamax decision. We need to protect Betamax. I mean, nobody here cares about Betamax, period, but that's the principle back in the 80s that was done. And so we have a do you know when the panel is? It's going to be on Grokster. Grokster recently went to the Supreme Court, and the decision came out about 2 months ago.
Tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
And they're going to talk about that. The indecision, the latest word on that is that Betamax still is in effect, but the variation on that was that Sony was going on TV saying, buy this VCR and make copies of TV shows. They were encouraging you to infringe. The Supreme Court said in the Grokster decision that if you induce infringement by advertising your product can be used for that purpose, then you have done wrong. But if you don't advertise for that purpose and it has non-infringing purposes, then things are fine.
But in itself, once you get to that, the Supreme Court also ruled that as long as it was not given out to public consumption for a fee, that it was still okay.
Excellent point. Back in about 86, I believe it was, or was it 96? Was it 96? I think in 96, they revised the copyright law. There is a definition section of the law. It's a very long law. There's a definition section that basically you're saying, but it's only wrong if you do it for commercial purposes. Excellent. So the lobby I just got through talking about went to Congress and said, let's change the definition of commercial interest. And so they changed the definition. And they said the initial, the Lamakia case was very interesting in that it was a wire fraud thing with basically a bulletin board where you could download anything you wanted. And it wasn't a crime because there was no money changing hands. And what it is, they went to Congress and they said, let's change the definition of commercial interest. Let's say that all works have a value. Let's say the works have a value of $100. So every song is worth $100. If you move more than $100, I'm making the numbers up, there's something like this. So if you move more than, I think the law says, $1,000 worth of songs, then that's considered to be commercial. And then because this is extremely damaging to us, we want statutory compensation of, let's say, $150,000 statutory compensation without proving damages per incident or per song. And so there's some number, I don't know what it is, I really ought to figure out the formula, but if you're involved with more than, say, 10 songs, like if you have a brother and a sister, and the brother gives not 10 but 11 songs to the sister, that's a commercial transaction. And that's a federal felony with 11 times $150,000 in statutory damages that aren't required to be damaged to be proven because it's statutory. You don't have to. Does that answer your question?
Pretty much.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
You might have heard recently that the recording industry has said that their sales are down, I think, something like 7%, and naturally they're blaming file sharing on that.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, it's also the possibility that the reason their sales are down is because most of their material in recent years is basically just crap encased in plastic.
Interesting point.
And I wonder what's going to happen when they finally get all these draconian laws passed and their sales are still down. What are they going to blame it on then?
Well, that's a good point. I don't really need to answer that, but it's a rhetorical question you're asking there. It's a good point. There's a lot of reason why songs don't, music's not selling like it used to. I'll point to my reason. I'll tell you right now, I don't get paid the same thing people get paid at McDonald's for flipping hamburgers. I get paid a little more than that. My time is worth such that I don't want to spend a lot of time copying music. I'll tell you right now, if I go to the music store, whether that's Turtles, which went out of business, or Best Buys, or whoever I get it from, and buy a CD with the MP3s already on there, I would purchase that over trying to copy my own. But you want to know something? I don't know a single label that produces MP3s for sale. And you know what? When I had 33 and a third RPM records and 45 RPM records, I had a player for that, and they sold that stuff. When I had a cassette player, they sold cassettes. When I had an 8-track player, you know what? They sold 8-tracks. I don't know why they sold 8-tracks, but they did. Okay? They sold 8-tracks. When they came up with the CD format, it took me a while to convert to it. I finally spent a month shopping for CD players and wasted 100 hours of my time going over the difference in $50 between one and the other, and immediately the next day bought $1,000 worth of CDs, wondering why I worried about the $50 between one player and the next. But they made CDs available in that, about 10 songs per CD format. I can fit 150 MP3s on one CD. I can play that in my DVD player. I can play it in my computer. I can play it in certain car stereos as well. Not the one from the factory, but one I can put in there. It's a much better format for me, 150 songs that I like, rather than 10 songs, only one that I like. I like that format much better. For some reason, the music industry has chosen specifically to refuse to sell me my preferred format. I don't know why they did that, but I'll tell you right now, that's affected my sales. If they sold it in my preferred format, I would buy it. I don't care if I get it cheaper. You know what? This water's free. I buy bottled water all the time. The fact that I can get it for free does not affect the fact that I will pay for it as well. I buy bottled water all the time, though you can get water for free anywhere. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Do most states have groups like yours?
Most states do not have groups like ours. There have been a grand total of probably, that I know of, about 10 groups like ours in different states. And the number varies from year to year. And some of them go dormant for 1 year, and then they come back, and some of them just disappear and never reappear. There was a group like this in Florida at one time. Now there's not. There were two groups like this in Texas, and some years there's two groups, some years there's no group, some years there's one group. It's the same people, but just the group is either there or not from year to year. There's been about a total of 10 altogether. Next question. Yes, sir.
As an IT manager at a company, I'm responsible for backing up and restoring end-user desktops and laptops, and I frequently find a 4-gig collection of MP3s. What's the corporate liability for an employee getting into that? Will we have a panel discussing that sometime, or is there a site I can determine the potential liabilities?
I don't think there's a panel about that. You need to talk with your attorney about that. If is it a relatively large company that you're part of, or just a small company?
It's making
about
20 to 30.
Okay, well, let's suppose that you had, say, you know, over 1,000 employees. You probably, if you had over 5,000 employees, my suggestion to you would be, if you had over 5,000 employees and you occasionally found this on machines, that your total liability would probably be greater than, based on statutory damages, would probably be greater than the gross national product of most small countries, because your liability for each song is, I believe, by statute, $150,000. And they don't have to prove damages. They don't even have to prove that anyone ever saw it ever or ever played it. Just say it exists. So, yes, you have some extreme and some absurd liability that has no connection with reality. But you need to talk to an attorney about that. I'm not an attorney.
What I've been told by my company is, because we have a corporate policy against having those things on our desktops, that if the desktop is backed up and it's coincidentally taken onto backup media, we are covered because we have a good faith effort to make it against our policy in the corporate level.
Well, like I said, I'm not an attorney, and you know, I'm willing to believe that. The general policy has been that that when these laws were put into place back in 96 and other times, that the content owners, the recording industry, would never sue individuals, but would only sue large companies that did this, you know, as a way to make commercial money. However, as they've sued grandmothers, people who are dead, and 8-year-old children, we have seen that these promises we were given a few years ago have no basis in reality whatsoever. And the idea of suing a 12-year-old for, $500,000 because she has a few dozen songs on her computer or a few hundred songs on her computers is not the way to solve the problem. Any other questions, comments?
I want to make sure, if you are interested in Electronic Frontiers Georgia, even just knowing more about us, we do have the sign-up in the back. It's a sign-up for our mailing list, and I think the volume recently is quite low, so it's not like you're going to get buried. But we send out some information every once in a while that you might be interested in. We also have some information about Electronic Frontier Foundation, even though we're not officially connected with them. We have some information back there. We have some membership forms and stickers now, and I think I know who just walked in the room, so I do encourage you. There are other groups out there. There's a Tennessee Digital Freedom Foundation. There used to be a group in Texas. If there is a way, if you do hear about a group forming in your area, I do encourage you to get involved and active. I also encourage that if you feel that your life is just too busy and you're swamped, that at least take the time to write a check and support your nearest or even your favorite organization out there. There's EFF, there's EPIC, Electronic Privacy Information Center, there's Public Knowledge, there's a couple of others that are very much worth looking at. So do take the time to support them one way or the other, and we would certainly appreciate that.
Well, thank you, everybody.